All right, welcome to It Could Happen Here, a podcast about things falling apart, and also sometimes about how things have been falling apart for a while now. And today we're going to talk about how things were also bad and falling apart in the 2000s, which are a profoundly cursed time period. And specifically, we're going to talk about, I think, a part of the anti-war movement that does not get much attention, which is the port militarization resistance that happened sort of 2006-2007. And with us today to talk about this is two people who were part of this movement. We have Juliana Neuhauser. Hello.
Hello.
And Brendan Maslauskas-Dunn. Yeah, both of whom were organizers and activists while this was going on. Yeah, and thank you both for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So, yeah, as I was saying a bit in the intro, I think that this is a part of the anti-war movement that is not very well known. I think a lot of people know about the initial stuff that happened in 2003, and people might know about some of the stuff that was happening against the war in Afghanistan, like right when it started. But I don't think most people know that it, like, you know, even after 2003 sort of doesn't work, that it continues and that it continues sort of in forms that are very interesting. And I guess I want you to start out. I want to ask how we sort of got from the early part of the anti-war movement into this and how you two got involved.
I would say that there's this narrative about the movement against the war in Iraq that there was the largest protests in human history, at least at that point. I don't know if it's still true, against the invasion. And then it didn't work and everyone kind of went home and ended there. And to a certain extent, that's true. But like you said, the people that didn't go home went in interesting directions. And so at the time, there were direct action was not as acceptable as it is now. The protest movement was largely dominated either by big liberal coalitions or PSL front groups that were basically indistinguishable in what they actually did, which was basically nothing. And in the best of cases, and in the worst of cases, counterinsurgency. But then there were small groups of people that when we saw that it didn't work, and we saw that these giant peaceful marches from one part of town to another, or voting for John Kerry or whatever, didn't work, that we started to look for other options.
Yeah, and I got involved, I'd say with the anti-war movement, that idea of how war is unjust was really taught to me from a very young age. I mean, my parents were, children of the 60s, and they had family members fighting in Vietnam and, friends dying in Vietnam and were against the protests back then. So I grew up hearing these stories, and of course, stories from family members, particularly one of my grandfathers, both of them who were veterans in World War II. One of them was a Marine in the, in the Pacific Theater, and still into his 70s, 80s, and 90s until his final days, was just dealing with horrific PTSD, and had always taught me from a young age never to get involved. So I, and I remember when the very clearly, I'm sure it's on everyone's minds now, when the invasion of Afghanistan started, when the invasion of Iraq started. I was at that massive demonstration in Washington, D.C. that Juliana just mentioned. And, I ended up, I'm from Utica, New York. I went to a rural high school just outside of Utica, Rust Belt, generally speaking, impoverished and also very conservative area of New York. And, I had the recruiters bothering me, military recruiters in high school, recruiting my friends, and they were just everywhere in the hallways. So it was very present with me when I was younger. I moved out to Olympia, Washington, 2006. And that's when a new student activist group, Students for a Democratic Society, was launched. That's how Juliana and I first met. We were both in separate chapters of that new organization in the Pacific Northwest. And the port protests started just a few months after I moved out there in Olympia in 2006.
So wait, just to clarify this for a second, because I've never quite been clear on this history. So there was a second SD, like Students for Democratic Society, that was like unrelated to the first one?
Yeah, okay, it was reborn briefly at the end of the Bush administration.
That explains a lot of things that were otherwise very baffling.
We're not that old. Yeah, we were definitely in the second, the rebirth of it. I think it took on some things in spirit, but also was, I'd say, different in many ways. And it was very active. To me, at least, it was very exciting to be a member of the new SDS, because there are over a dozen chapters in the Pacific Northwest, and it was a great way to connect with young activists all over the U.S.
So SDS is emerging in this time period. One of the other things I was interested about is something you were talking about in the early part of this, which has to do with the way that these giant, both the sort of Answer Coalition, PSL Frank Group, and I guess the ISO was still around back then, coalitions work versus how like anything else worked. I'm interested. So was SDS sort of like consciously set up in opposition to those groups?
I don't think it was conscious, but there was just like, these days, there's a lot of controversy around PSL with like anarchist versus tanky politics. Mm-hmm. None of that mattered at that time. Like none of that mattered. The only thing that mattered was that Answer, which was the PSL front group, was completely fucking useless. Like they completely indistinguishable from any peace police, liberal democratic front group. There was literally no difference, just in terms of their aesthetics, maybe. Like, is there a donkey or a hammer and sickle on something? That's the only difference we saw. So I don't think there was, there wasn't like a conscious like political opposition to it. It was just like they're not doing anything. Mm-hmm. And so we had to look in another direction.
Actually, it's hard to keep track of the alphabet soup of authoritarian communist groups at times. But this was actually Answer, for those who don't recall. It was a front group for the Workers' World Party, the WWP, it's hard to keep track, right?
Yeah, it's the same thing. Like,
I think so for people who are sort of unaware of this, there's a network of connected but sometimes feuding like weird Stalinist cults that they hold on through the 80s and 90s, and they start sort of rebuilding again around the anti-war movements in that period. That's the PSL, that's WWP, that's Answer. Like, I think that like most like modern anti-war groups are also still these people, which is incredibly depressing. Something I want to talk a bit about at towards the end of this. But yeah, just for people who have not spent like the last half decade in the trenches of extremely weird anti-war politics. So yeah, so I think we should get into how the sort of the first action starts in Olympia.
Yeah, so, and there were actually a couple actions that happened in the year preceding that, before I moved out to Olympia in 2006. Mm-hmm. It was not yet under the banner of PMR, Port Militarization Resistance. That was a name that was officially coined in May and June of 2006. And so just to give you an idea, Olympia, it's a college town, right? The Evergreen State College is there. It's also the capital of Washington State, so you have that going on. It's also a military town. It's a little over 20 miles south of what we called Fort Lewis. It's now called JBLM, JBLM, or Joint Base Lewis-McChord. It's an Army and Air Force base. Now it's one base. So you had all these, different kind of elements in tandem in that town. And the public port, the Port of Olympia, is one of about 70 or so public ports in the state of Washington, some of which are, they're used for all kinds of things, for our commercial, private industry, but also the military and the U.S. government. I heard from someone, I don't even remember who, that the military was sending a ship to the port of Olympia in late May of 2006. And this happened for 10 or so days. And it was just kind of a natural instinct for a whole bunch of us to go down to the port of Olympia. It was the war machine in our backyard. And the idea was to just block the vehicles. It started out with just like less than 10 people, number of folks getting arrested. And that very rapidly culminated into larger protests every single day, an act of blockades. People, those of us like Juliana, myself, and other folks using civil disobedience, or what we preferred to call civil resistance, to try and stop or at the very least slow down these striker vehicles. And to give folks an idea of what a striker vehicle is, you can look it up online, but it's kind of halfway between, a tank and a Humvee. It doesn't have the slats, you know, that a tank would have. It's, you know, and they were being used in both Iraq and Afghanistan for raids of residential areas. They were really on the front lines of the war in both those countries. And that's what we were trying to stop.
I only got involved later because I wasn't living in Olympia at the time. I was in another SDS chapter, but my roommate was from Olympia and he had been involved in that first round of protests in Olympia before moving up to Bellingham. Yeah, and so like hearing his story, it's got me very excited because it's like finally someone's doing something. Like they're not just like, you know, it's like everything else was just so liberal. Like whether it was marching from one place to another or writing to your Congress people or occupying their office, it was like asking someone else to do something, which you knew from the beginning they were never going to do.
Yeah.
And finally, someone was like actually getting into it. I think one of the things that happened here was that they started to avoid there's kind of a geographical thing that I think for people who either don't know Washington or because they're normal people don't know like the port areas of these cities very well, because it's like unless you're a longshireman, like why would you go down to like the port of Tacoma?
Yeah,
like, there's nothing there.
Yeah, no.
They kept moving it around because Olympia is also not very big. And so there's really only two roads into the port, which is very small. And so it's very easy to block it. And so then I think the first time that I got involved was in 2007 when they had moved it, because they kept moving it around to try and switch things up. And
wait, sorry, they're moving the ship around? Is that...
They're moving. No, it's like each time they had to make a military shipment, they would, it's like once the ship was in the port, they would just have to go through with it.
Okay.
But then, it's like every 6 months or so, they had to make another military shipment, and they would change the port, usually each time, to try and to avoid us. It doesn't seem like this is like normal practice.
Yeah.
The first time I had gone down was in Tacoma, which is a much, much, much more industrialized port than Olympia. It's, you know, it's like a big port, like a more normal port, I guess. And that one was honestly pretty crazy because you're just trapped in this giant industrial maze, basically at the mercy of the riot cops. The best success we had was definitely at the port of Olympia. I think in 2007 in Olympia was definitely, I guess, like the glory moment, which was when people were able to on and off like actually hold the port and control its entrances. Wow. And exits.
Yeah, and I want to just emphasize that, like, the military changing their approach, right, to avoid us, so jumping from port to port with these different shipments. They actually went so far because we were so successful as a movement in the Pacific Northwest
to ship Stryker vehicles by rail out of the Pacific Northwest, and even going so far as to ports in Texas.
Wow.
But you know, one thing that we did is that we built up contacts with other activists, with longshore workers all up and down the West Coast in California. There are other activists we're connected with in Texas, Hawaii, New Jersey, and New York. There is a desire in the anti-war movement, and you know, in some extent, maybe it's like it was small, but some folks in the labor movement, especially in Oakland, where the ILWU, the Longshore Workers Union, is a lot more militant than, say, in a place like Olympia.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, people wanted to replicate this model because, as Juliana said, we were successful in 2007. We shut down the port of Olympia for a total of, it was essentially 2 days. They're not shipping anything in or out. We set up blockades. We're willing to throw down with the police in the street.
And one of the things that was cool about that blockade is that there's two entrances, like I said, and one was completely blockaded. And then the other one, we had like a moving, I don't really even know what it was, but something with wheels that we could move in and out to open it up. And so then we could allow like civilian cargo to move in and out, but then like we wheel it back in place to block military shipments.
So were you able to actually like stop them from like while in that one in Tacoma, were you able to actually like stop them from moving the stuff altogether, or did you eventually get cleared up by the police and they moved it?
We would eventually get cleared out by the police. It's like we were never able to. It's like we held it for 2 days. Those protests took place over a series of 2 weeks or more or less. We were only able to fully hold it for 2 days before eventually they would clear us out. But one of the things is that it did create problems for the Army, because when you work with a port, you know, it's like you've got like a certain time frame that you've contracted with the port to do whatever it is you're going to do. And it's not too happy if you take longer than you said you would. Or
the other thing I want to add is, you know, I think the other really important element with this whole movement going on is the Pacific Northwest was is specifically Western Washington, where the two of us were living. It was the center, in a sense, it was the heart of the anti-war movement in the country at that time. One, because of this militant direct action that we were building up in the streets and trying to throw a wrench in the gears of the war machine to at the very least slow it down, which in some ways we did, but you know, we were up against so much. But the other added element, of course, is the GI resistance and the soldiers who are resisting. IVAW, also known as Iraq Veterans Against the War, was very active there. They set up a GI coffee house across, you know, literally across the street, the gates for one of the entrances for Fort Lewis. There are a whole bunch of soldiers that were going AWOL. We had friends who were active duty soldiers who had fought in, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan that were AWOL, and they were hiding, you know, refusing to go back into these Stryker brigades that joined us in port militarization resistance. There were a whole, you know, long list of soldiers that were very publicly saying, you know, I'm refusing to fight in Iraq or Afghanistan for, you know, various reasons. And so we are very much connected with this movement too. And I think the higher ups in the military, they're hyper aware of that. They studied us very well, you know, to the point of actually, you know, spying on us. So that's like a whole other element of the story too.
So one of the things that I've heard from talking to other people who were involved in this was that, like, while like during these protests, like the level of police militarization just like skyrocketed. And like I remember, I was talking to a friend about this. It was like, you know, if you go back and look at like old System of a Down videos, you know, they'll have these things. Yeah, and you'll see these riot police, and like you look at them, and it's like these people, they look so much less armored than like the people that we have now. And one of the things I thought was interesting about this was that like this is, I think, one of the points where you start getting the modern riot police showing up that are just like, you know, completely encased in like armor. And yeah, I want to talk about just like the police response to this, because I think that's another thing. I think there's a kind of a tendency to sort of project back what the police look like in 2021 just onto the whole history of police. And I think it's like it's gotten worse even in the last 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, so I live downtown in Olympia and probably just like a 6-minute walk away from the Port of Olympia, and also very conveniently just a few blocks away from the police station. So lucky us. So we actually saw, you know, we could see from the front of down on the road, down on the sidewalk from the front of our house, some of the military shipments going by. And we did see that, absolutely. And at times it was terrifying. I mean, I lived in an activist house we jokingly called HQ, because that's just, you know, where it, because of its proximity to the port, that's where a number of us were having meetings, you know, around these protests early on in 2006. And yeah, I mean, we like, they look like RoboCop. And it's something I had been to like mass marches and demonstrations, like the RNC protests and DNC protests in Boston, New York, and like in Washington, D.C. And so I would see these like riot cops, but they were, I mean, ubiquitous in these port protests. It was like a whole army of them that was sent out. I mean, when Juliana said that things got kind of crazy at the Port of Tacoma protests, I mean, there was like a police riot. You know, like the cops went absolutely nuts. They're shooting people with tear gas and pepper balls and brutalizing people. I'd never before witnessed anything like that. And it got to the point in, you know, in Olympia where we kind of knew early on that we were being traced by the police, to the extent where, you know, one friend of ours was followed from our house to the bus station to take a bus to school by the police, and then was stopped and essentially assaulted by them on the street. And we had another fellow activist and you know, a roommate of mine who was driving out with a few friends, a few fellow activists from Olympia to Aberdeen, about an hour's drive. So Aberdeen, there's a Port of Grays Harbor there, pretty conservative small town. It's where Kurt Cobain is from.
Home of the famous Kurt Cobain themed McDonald's.
They served billions and billions served in that one McDonald's and Kurt Cobain's McDonald's. But yeah, I mean, they were following, they had orders, you know, the Washington State Patrol to, you know, pull over a car full of known anarchists. There was alert gone out to all the police departments. They pulled them over. They made him walk the line. He wasn't drinking, had no drugs, like nothing in his system, but he was driving under like 1 mile per hour under the speed limit. They arrested him for DWI, you know, eventually fought the charges, sued them, and, you know, won a big settlement out of all that. But that's just one example of many of the lengths that the police would go to. It was pretty severe. Even there's a house of a bunch of anarchists, younger anarchists, called Pitchpipe Info Shop in Tacoma. And that was also a big target. The police were swarming around them all the time.
They had like cameras set up like specifically just outside the info shop. Like there weren't surveillance cameras there before, but then there's like, oh, we'll just conveniently put them on this one specific street corner.
Yeah, I think like that was one of the things I was reading about this is you have that stuff. And then also, I think one of the scariest parts of this is that like army intelligence gets involved. And yeah, do you want to talk about the man named quote unquote John Jacob, who was in fact not that?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm curious what memories you have of our good dear friend, John Jacob, Juliana.
I don't think I ever actually knew him in person, but he was the moderator of the listserv, wasn't he?
Yes, and he was one of the moderators of our listserv.
Now that I look back on it, I'm like, the Port Militarization Resistance, the listserv was always just like this dramatic shit show. And it's like, looking back on it, I was like, oh. Moderated by a cop that did nothing, did absolutely nothing to like establish order or, I wonder if that was on purpose.
Yeah. So I think there's definitely some things that happen, like, you know, looking back from our vantage point today, it's like, okay, things make a little more sense. At the time, though, I mean, we were in this movement, right? And so that means like meeting people where they're at. We would find all kinds of people that would like want to join the movement. Like I said earlier, like active duty soldiers that were joining. So I met this guy named John Jacob, and he sent an email out to me. I was one of the contacts for the Olympia SDS group. And it's like, hey, you know, there's kind of like a parent organization that some old, like elder activists are in to kind of mentor us, called Movement for a Democratic Society. Very small, never really took off, but it's like, I'm interested in getting involved. We met up in public and he seemed like an all right guy. I mean, he was, you know, 40-ish, early 40s. He told me he had like, you know, been in the military for years and he actually still worked at Fort Lewis. So he was always open about that, but it only went that far. He didn't ever tell us what he actually did there. And it wasn't abnormal for, you know, we had many folks that worked active duty, you know, on base and civilian roles or soldiers, as I mentioned, that were in Port Militarization Resistance. So he gets involved and he gets really involved with Port Militarization Resistance. He goes to protests. He gets pretty close with this group of anarchists I mentioned who lived in Tacoma. And he seemed like a really solid guy to most of us. And, you know, things happen as we progress and, you know, as the military responded to our, you know, how effective we were in the anti-war movement and the GI resistance movement by changing their tactics. We noticed that, okay, when we first started the protests, we had the ability to catch the police by surprise by setting up, you know, a blockade here or having a surprise action there at this time or this port, et cetera, et cetera. And as time progressed, we found out that, you know, we were having making these decisions for tactics and our strategy. We thought that we're in private. And then for whatever reason, the police kind of knew about where we were going to be before we even showed up. And that I remember that like, clearly happening in 2007 in the Port of Olympia.
Yeah, in Tacoma, there's a lot of things like that. Like, there was one time when there were, like, some people who had a meeting in a closed room with, like, they had taken, like, the batteries out of their cell phones. They had simply written on the whiteboard the time and place they were going to have their next meeting, which is going to be in a diner near the port. And so that way, if for any reason the room was bugged, it wouldn't be caught up, because it was just written on a board. And then it was like a small meeting too. So it's like there wouldn't. And then when they got to that diner, there was like full of cops and like clearly waiting for them. Like at that point, it's like it was very clear there was some level of infiltration involved.
Yeah. And I think we, from early on, like, you know, we knew our history. I mean, you know, one of our fellow activists in PMR and a friend of ours, Peter Bomer, is a professor at the Evergreen State College. He was in the original SDS back in the 60s. And, you know, he was essentially a political prisoner for a couple of years in both Massachusetts and California. I mean, the feds essentially tried to assassinate him back in the 70s when he was active in the anti-war movement in San Diego. Like, we knew, you know, former Black Panthers, and we read our history. So we knew about the history of COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program of the 60s and 70s, and the war on the anti-war and civil rights and Black power, American Indian movements, et cetera. So we knew, you know, just intuitively early on. But there was one thing that happened in particular, which prompted some of us to file for a public records request with the city of Olympia. And another activist is walking down the street in Olympia. I'm a member of the Wobblies, Industrial Workers of the World Union. And we had like one of those metal newspaper boxes downtown, and it was locked to a pole, you know, with a bike lock. And there are some city workers there with a pickup truck, and they're cutting the lock
to this newspaper box and they threw it in their pickup truck. And so our, you know, this friend of ours was there and was like, what the hell, what are you doing? What's going on? And one of the workers just kind of shrugged and was like, I don't know, the police told us to do this. And they drove off. Like they stole, you know, our, or essentially like our union property or whatever. So we had, you know, our lawyer friend, Larry Hildes and the National Lawyers Guild, you know, call and kind of threaten the city. And then a number of us got together like, hey, you know, let's do like a public records request with the city of Olympia, freedom of information law. Right. And so we did. And the request was, you know, just requesting any and all information the city had, any exchanges, communications by email, et cetera, between the police and like other agencies about anarchists, the IWW, Students for a Democratic Society. And their initial search that the city clerk did yielded something like 30,000 responses. So she's like, okay, I got to narrow this down. And I don't know, I was working on the request at the time. And for some reason, like, I don't know, we're port protests, we're near a military base, communications between the army, not thinking anything. And so the initial responses, we actually got, you know, maybe 130 or so different documents, just copies of emails, et cetera, that were little puzzle pieces for this massive puzzle. And it was just a few of them. And it was, you know, there was an email talking about our guy in the Navy going to a PMR meeting to get some intel. There's, you know, all kinds of things like that. There were a few emails in particular, and the email address was something like John J. Towery at, you know, army.us, whatever the email address was. So there's a crew of activists that got together, put their heads together, did some research quietly for a few months, and eventually found out by publicly accessible information like voter registration records, and also finding out something about like a motorcycle club called like the, I don't know, like the Brown Butte Club or the Brown Butt Club or something. And like found out that this John Towery guy that was in this motorcycle club and had his, you know, was registered to vote outside of Tacoma in this town there. It was actually John Jacob. It was this guy that we thought was a fellow activist, an anarchist, and a friend. You know, I thought he was a personal friend of mine. Turns out he was actually essentially an Army intelligence officer working for something called a force protection unit at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, and also working with a whole list of different agencies and what turned out to be like a massive surveillance network that was national in scope. This guy was sent by the Army along with many others to infiltrate us, to spy on us, and to disrupt us. It was huge.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I've always thought was really interesting about this. I learned about poor militarization resistance basically because I was like poking around the history of like informants, and I ran into this and I was like, what? Because, and then that was what I thought, one of the things I thought was really interesting about this is that like I think this chapter of the anti-war movement is, even on the left, is like not very well known. But like the seriousness with which the Army seems to have taken it is really remarkable. Yeah, I'm wondering what you two think about that.
One thing we have to emphasize is that we were not a large group of people.
Yeah.
Like the number of people who are actively involved in port militarization resistance at its peak was, how many people do you think it was, Brandon?
Well, it depends. I mean, I'd say there are probably like at its peak, maybe probably 40 to 50 people that would like consistently show up to things, you know, maybe a slightly smaller, very core group, but we would have demonstrations with like,
and then like, yeah,
400 people, you know?
Yeah. And like, that would be like the max. Like there is, it's like, there are like the peaceful, like kind of like support actions, you know, you'd get like a couple hundred people. And then like for the stuff like, where it's like the first night that that the part of the entrance to the Port of Olympia was occupied, it would be like 40 to 50 people. These were not very large groups of people. I feel like, and like I said, it's like one thing that we need to keep in mind was that the peace police were much stronger back then than they are now. Nowadays, like as we saw last year, it's like people in the US have learned to throw down, but that was not the case at the time. And so this is a very, very small group of people. And I think we accomplished a lot with how small it was. If it had been larger, it would have accomplished way more. But even that small core of like 40 to 50 people, with maybe expanding out to like a larger group of a couple hundred, had them that scared that they went that far to try and disrupt it.
Yeah, and this is one of the things I've been thinking about a lot recently of this seems to be a very consistent thing, which is that like the two things that are guaranteed to like just have a hammer drop on you if you touch them is pipelines and ports. And that was something, you know, we've talked a lot on here about pipeline protests. But I was interested in what you two think about, because yeah, this is like a very particular moment right now in which you're dealing with all these logistics chain failures. And I was wondering if you do think there's anything that we can learn from how your versions of the sort of port demonstrations worked for potentially trying to leverage that in the future, especially with like contract negotiations for the like port workers in Oakland coming up next year.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, there's this old saying in the IWW, direct action gets the goods, right? And I think it really boils down to that. It's building up, you know, mass movements and social movements from below that rely on direct action, that rely on civil resistance, civil disobedience. Yeah, and the pipeline protests that have been ongoing, where Indigenous people have been on the front lines of that for many, many years now. I mean, the kind of repression and surveillance that we face really pales in comparison to the kinds of, you know, surveillance and repression that folks were facing at Standing Rock, for example. You know, I think, of course, one of the main differences is that it was primarily the military, you know, with us, right, that was surveilling us, because this was very specifically, you know, a war issue and a military issue. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, like, I think there's a big question, like, what do we have to do that's new? And to me, I say, you know, for both that kind of militant action, but also for the labor movement, it's like, it's not, you know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. There are things that have a tried and true track record of getting the goods. And that is, you know, these more disruptive kind of actions and movements. And so one of them would be, you know, I guess my suggestion would be to like go back to the basics. And even like, I would say now, you know, this is at a time when like Facebook was around, right? Like, but we weren't really using that for our organizing. We really relied on like face-to-face meetings, you know, phone calls, and building up trust with people and building up our capacity to like take actions and make change. You know, I think, I'm not saying throw out everything that, you know, at least some of the good that social media has to offer, but like, I think going beyond that and going back to these older tactics. And then for the labor movement, like the big thing is, you know, and it's just like a bigger question for mainstream unions in particular. I mean, the whole idea of like union contracts is that workers also lose a lot. Yeah, they get some things, but business owners and bosses have rights carved out in those contracts. Yeah. And with the longshore workers, I mean, the difficult thing with that, of course, is like there would be some symbolic strikes that, of course, like longshore workers have done and continue to do, you know, around like the war in Iraq, historically supporting Mumia Abu-Jamal, May Day, et cetera, like in Oakland. But they have some things for that written into their contracts. And, mm-hmm. you know, for all these other like unions, it's like, well, you know, we can't strike at all for for the next 2 years or next 3 years, whatever the life of the contract is. Like, I think it's a bigger question and challenge for the labor movement to move beyond that and not be put in this straitjacket of contracts like that.
Yeah, I think that particular, like the no strike clause part of contracts, I think is an interesting thing because it I don't know. There are some unions that will actually do stuff around fighting it, but mostly people just sort of don't care. And I think you wind up in a situation where it seems like you kind of have to plan your tactics around when contract negotiations are happening, because otherwise you can't actually get people to do anything more than like a 1 day symbolic strike.
Yeah. And, or, you know, the challenge is like, you know, we have this great American tradition that's not unique to the US. It's universal, really. And it's one that resonates with me, breaking the law. Right. And, and like, we're like civil disobedience. That is that what we are doing in the streets and blocking the ports, we were breaking the law and we knew it. And that's what the civil rights movement, the Black Freedom Movement, did in the 1960s. But like, we have recent examples of workers breaking the law en masse,
yep,
like the West Virginia teacher strikes that happened a few years ago. Like, teachers in every single county in that state went on strike. They broke the law and they won something out of that. And I think that's what we really need to encourage people, is this idea of breaking out of like the norm and breaking the laws, which, you know, the laws that are in place, which are not there to, you know, expand our freedom. They're yep, to contract it.
Yeah. One of my friends had a joke about, what was the exact line? It was, it's only illegal if you get caught, and it only matters if you lose, which I think is a good way of thinking about breaking the law. And you know, yeah, I think it's also like, it's worth mentioning that like the other side, the law doesn't matter to them at all. Like, they just tear it up and like light it on fire constantly. So don't bind yourself. If you can not get caught and not like go to prison for the rest of your life, don't bind yourself by a bunch of like paper that the other side just doesn't care about.
Yeah, and that's an excellent point, because that's the big thing, you know, with the army and law enforcement in general, like surveillance of us. They were, and the police, just their actions or brazen actions on the street, like the riot police, they were just breaking the law all the time. They absolutely have a deep, visceral hatred of the Bill of Rights, of civil rights and civil liberties. And so there were a number of, you know, court cases that sprung out of, you know, this movement. There was a case called Panagakis v. Tauri. Another, Juliana Panagakis, was another PMR member, co-plaintiff in that case. And, you know, it was a case against the army that, you know, we waged and brought up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and, you know, eventually lost, and could have brought it to the Supreme Court, but didn't. But, you know, like the other thing is like the violation of the Posse Comitatus Act. It was a whole other thing. You know, we don't have to get like so tied up into like the legalistic thing, but like your point is valid. Like, they don't care about the laws that are already there. They'll just intentionally break them, break their own laws that they have set up, and, you know, they'll just get a slap on the wrist, because that's all that happens to them.
I think that's a good note to end on. Break the law. It's fake. It's also bad. Do you two have anything you want to plug?
Other than that, other than, you know, encouraging people to break the law.
Do anarchism. Blockade your local port.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, I guess just encourage people to do, as, you know, it sounds like what you're doing by having us on the show. And like, there are some in our very recent history, you know, movements and wins that we all as activists today can still learn from. And I think part of that, you know, I don't want to call us elders because we're not that old, but like one part of that is like making sure like our movements are still like a multi-generational, and like we learn from each other. And also, as Juliana and I did, like I mentioned earlier, like we learned from the movements of the past, SDS, the Black Panthers, the Black Freedom Movement, et cetera. But there's a lot that, you know, these struggles, I think, have to offer us today.
All right. Well, thank you both for coming on and talking with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Well, this has been It Could Happen Here. Find us at Happen Here Pod on Twitter and Instagram, and the rest of our stuff is at Cool Zone Media at the same somewhat accursed social media places. I don't know why I'm saying somewhat. They're just accursed. Yeah. See you next time, whenever that is.
It Could Happen Here is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find sources for It Could Happen Here updated monthly at coolzonemedia.com/sources. Thanks for listening.